Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is Wednesday, June 10th, 2020. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. With me, as always, Associate Editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
Senior Writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
And Senior Editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
So here is a question that I want to raise, and we can go into detail with an article, stunning article today in the Washington Post that helped that clarify these ideas for me. But what if what we're seeing here is a kind of mainstreaming and middle classing of the phenomenon that Tom Wolfe called radical chic? That is to say, radical chic was, of course, the portrait of a party in 1970 at the home of Leonard Bernstein, at which New York's most fashionable, show-busy people were present for a presentation of the Black Panthers to this kind of high glam society. And you had this kind of kowtowing to the to these thugs and radicals by the limousine liberal set. This is sort of where the idea of limousine liberalism first kind of gained purchase. So what we see now is this radical increase in polling in the belief among white liberals that racism is systemic, that the country needs to do more, that Black people, they now view Black people more positively than white people. They view Black concerns as more important than other concerns. And I just wonder whether this is a triumph, a sort of PR social triumph of the very attitudes that Wolf was parodying 50 years ago.
Well, can I speak as, since I'm a white woman and I'm clearly, you know, I have to speak from my experience in all things. I'm saying this sarcastically. The Washington Post article really was an intriguing moment of clarity because it's interviewing, obviously, upper middle class white women who live in the suburb, you know, in parts of Minneapolis that were close enough to the rioting and looting and destruction and mayhem of the protests to raise their concern, but still far removed enough that they could have kind of, you know, tortured Facebook discussion groups about how they should feel about it. So one of the women it was like watching a struggle session by Sybil with multiple personalities. She begins the article saying, well, I don't feel comfortable saying that I'm uncomfortable with looting because that seems wrong. By the end, she's saying, you know, well, it's a righteous expression of anger, and I understand it, and it's a target. So that's a global corporation, so I don't have to worry about it. But you can see as the article progresses, the pressure and to make this more Manichaean and less complicated than it is. And the part of the article that really struck me was a rally where there were lots of people, including Ilhan Omar, arguing for the defunding or abolition of the police. And some African-American students from a high school that has police officers stationed there for the kids' safety said, you know, we love the officer who's here. He's a second father to me. For one kid said, I don't have a father. He's like a father to me. He coaches our football team. This is a member of our community who also happens to be African-American. And what these upper middle class white ladies are saying is, no, he's a tool of racist oppression. We're going to remove him from your community because we know he's bad because he wears a uniform. And the lack of ability to see the complexities of these issues for the communities they claim to be helping while trying to justify in their own minds violence and looting was a remarkable crystallization of a kind of radicalization we haven't seen before.
Okay, and you know what? Let's step back. Let me read from Greg Jaffe's piece in the Washington Post, the headline of which is, after killing of George Floyd, white liberals embrace ideas that once seemed radical. Okay, I'll try to edit as I go. 3 days after a police officer knelt on George Floyd's neck, killing him, and only a few hours after enraged looters ransacked a Target and torched an AutoZone, Meredith Webb woke to an early morning message from a close friend across the street. Beloved city, so much pain, the text from her neighbor Michelle Garvey read. Exploding pain, replied Webb, who had seen the news and cried. Can we talk outside in a little while? Theirs is a block of mostly white liberal families tucked inside cute bungalows with carefully tended gardens and century-old shade trees. The two women met on the sidewalk where their sons, aged 5 and 7, had spent much of the last few weeks racing back and forth on their bikes and scooters. On this morning, their conversation turned to the looting and fires that had unfolded just a few miles from their homes. To Garvey, 39, the destruction of the Target and surrounding stores was sad, but understandable, quote, a perfectly warranted and justified response, an expression of righteous rage, unquote. Webb, 33, wasn't there yet, and she felt a little guilty about it. I wasn't sure what side I was supposed to be on, she recalled. It felt wrong to say we're with you until the looting. In Washington, da 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 da. Okay, so liberals.
Oh, there's two big quotes in here that deserve to be pulled.
Yes.
One from this woman that Christine was talking about. Quote: I'm trying to push myself to understand looting, and understand that we have to go outside the law sometimes to make some things happen. And a later quote when she finally reaches this, period at which she's enlightened. It felt wrong to say that we were with you until you start looting, as you said before. That's crazy. Like the article says, these ideas seemed radical before, but implies they're not now. Right. Nope, they're all still really, really radical.
And in the very fact, and I've heard other people express it in similar terms, this idea that she has to push herself to sort of come around to looting means that she understands, as so many do inherently, that this violence and destruction is bad.
Well, there's
social science around this, and I think I'm writing about this today. Nick Christakis, I think he's Harvard. He was Harvard.
Yale.
Okay, Yale professor. Nicholas Christakis pushed out this study today, which is really fascinating, which used a variety of experiments to demonstrate how unpopular norms, things that you privately disapprove of, you can adopt, and not only adopt, but enforce enthusiastically in order to affect some kind of social change that you perceive to be of value, even if you don't understand the value yourself. So this is like human psychology here at work in a really perverse fashion.
But there's a weird thing going on as well when you look at the alliance it's forming with obviously privileged upper middle class white people and, you know, sort of more radical activists with whom they generally haven't shared these views of property. I mean, I showed you guys, my neighborhood's been blanketed by all these flyers, many of them kind of profane and awful and, you know, basically telling white people to go F themselves. But the series that were all over the cars, stapled to trees on every sign in the last 2 days, one of them says, stop hiding behind your privilege, stop putting your comfort before human life. The discomfort you say you felt over the past week is nothing compared to the terror Black Americans face every day. So there's this weird attempt to equate bourgeois comfort in safe neighborhoods. And I live in a relatively safe neighborhood. And yes, people were concerned when it turned to rioting and looting for a night. But the argument that fear is something that African Americans live with every day. The flyer says, you know, until a Black American can sit in their home, attend church, go on a jog, birdwatch, walk to the grocery store without fear, no one should be comfortable. That's a radical statement, right? That's not a statement that's trying to come to a common conversation about how we can all do better moving forward. But that is now the conversation and the tone of the conversation I see overtaking a lot of this discussion. And that's not going to end well for anyone, quite frankly.
Right. Well, let me get to the end of the piece, because this is a real crystallization of the moment. So Meredith Webb, whom we heard about at the beginning, the one who said she felt bad thinking that maybe looting was bad. As the week drew to a close, she headed off to one more demonstration, this one in a park in southern Minneapolis. She passed a torched drugstore that she hadn't noticed before and then settled down on the grass next to an old friend. Damn, the Walgreens, Webb said before catching herself. Not that I should be sad about a Walgreens. Well, they employed people, the friend replied. Yeah, Webb agreed. The host for the event approached a microphone draped with plastic flowers and got the rally underway with a call and repeat that had come to define the last 2 weeks of Minneapolis. Say his name, she said to the crowd of several hundred spread out on the grass in front of her. George Floyd, they replied. Say his name, she repeated a little louder. George Floyd. the crowd chanted back. So Meredith Webb from Decatur, Georgia, living in Minneapolis, Elizabeth Warren voter, founder of a Facebook group about white identity and discussing your sins against black people, pulls herself back from the idea that it's really too bad that a Walgreens drugstore was set on fire and destroyed, because that is simply not helpful to the cause. So we can call this madness. It is clearly madness, but it's something more than madness. Like, it's a way, when you say things are crazy, it's sort of like, well, you know, most people are going to agree that it's crazy. These people have like lost their minds, but they are representative of something much larger. Like, if you could say 5% of people have gotten to this place, and therefore, you know, the country is gonna spit this all out. We're gonna get through this, and it's all gonna go back to normal. I don't want to be apocalyptic about this, but this is soul crushing, and it is. There's a sense in which it's very hard to come back from attitudes like this.
Well, but if you think the analog here is radical chic, then the trajectory would suggest that this is cyclical.
Well, right. At the end of the day, the people who can least afford to be the most radical are the poor, because they actually do rely right. on the police to help, keep them alive in their own neighborhoods. It's the upper middle class white liberals who can, you know, hop on a plane and go rent a vacation house somewhere else, who can talk the talk, but are never really forced to live in the societies that they want to construct. I mean, this has been an ongoing theme when you talk about anarchists versus radicals, even. I mean, you see the privilege of being able to espouse such views exists because they are able to flee from the consequences of them.
Exactly. It's an anti-society view. And that's just not something that society can sustain. either it self-perpetuates,
sure, it can sustain it. We had more than 20 years of attitudes toward policing itself that, without a lot of ideological flavoring and coloring, led to the results of the crime wave. That is to say, cops were distrusted and thought ill of, and they stayed in their cars for 25 years. Like, yeah. That's a real world consequence that we could see happen again. Society didn't stop that from happening.
I unfortunately think this is something far worse than radical chic, because radical chic, as the term implies, has to do with a sort of fashion. You know, it's fashionable to adopt a particular radical cause and embrace it. This is worse because there's this personal dimension, right? These are sort of, people are offering their sort of self-forced confessions here about their privilege and their racism. So it's more total in terms of a mindset. And it's something, I think, far more global, not global in the sense of geography, but in terms of the culture and in terms of the people involved. This is a sort of paradigm shift in how they are going about their lives and looking at the world. It's not cocktail parties. It's not embracing causes. It's not merely placards. People describe being on their anti-racist journeys now.
Well, and if you read some of the core texts that are now being held up as what we should all be reading, and I'm reading Ibram X. Kendi's book about how to be an anti-racist, that is absolutely the worldview. It is illiberal in its core because it does not allow for any questioning of the system, either within or outside it, because everyone's infected by the same problem, right? There really is no nuance there, even though, interestingly, that his personal story he tells with great nuance and is quite compelling to read, but the conclusions he draws about how we should structure our society are the opposite of the nuance he brings to his own personal observation. So it's actually, it's making me sad to read the book, because he's clearly a pretty insightful and observant person, but the conclusions he's trying to get the world to come to are tragic. I will say, I have a huge amount of sympathy for the argument that we've been trying to do peaceful means. We've been trying to do reform. We've been trying to do all these things for all these years, and it hasn't worked. So now we have to step up and be louder or violent. Or I understand the emotional place that that comes from. But I wonder what is the appropriate response to. I've had I can think of all classes, races, ethnicities. I've heard that argument from lots of people who I care deeply about, and I'm not sure what the proper response to that is, except to say if we take that final step and argue that violence or all these other things are justifiable, how do you go back? How do you, you know, this is a path that leads you in a particular direction that's very difficult to restore.
My sympathy for that particular argument is very limited, to be honest, because it's not historically accurate. Peaceful means have been transformative. Yes. in achieving certain aims and making the country a more equal place, whereas there's a long history of failed violent means.
I think they mean specifically about police reform in this case. Like they say,
okay, okay, so let's talk about police reform. The idea that police are worse, more violent, more hostile toward Black people, more vicious and terrible to Black people is belied by every statistic we have known to man. And part of the reason is that we don't have all that many statistics from the bad old days, because cops didn't keep very good statistics. And they certainly, as famously was the case in New York City, did not really keep data about Black communities, about Harlem, about policing in bad neighborhoods. The collection of hard sociological, actually real-time reporting data and all that in relation to crime is of relatively recent vintage. And so we don't know how bad it was, but we know it was much worse. I'm sorry, we know it was much worse. The treatment of Black people in the South by authorities was... I mean, people think that, you know, you exist in a condition of sort of ritualistic humiliation with authorities on a day-to-day basis in 2020. 1920, the entire structure of these states and municipalities and townships and all of that were structured to this kind of ritualistic humiliation. And yes, we have a revolution of rising expectations, which is understandable. People know there's no longer any open mindset that says that Black people are inferior to white people and deserve to be treated differently and deserve to be, you know, under the suasion of other people. And so under those conditions, if you think that there was unequal application of the law or, unjust, that the relations between the authorities and Blacks are more unjust than they are between the authorities and other people. That's a serious issue, but it is ahistorical in the extreme to argue that things are worse. And every way, in every piece of data that we have, they are better. People may experience them as worse, and even worse, I would say, from Christine, from the anecdotes or the experiences you're having, just because white liberals are now more attuned to the issue than they used to be doesn't mean that because they've awakened to it, suddenly it's worse. That just means that they were solipsistic, self-centered, uninterested in the condition and the experiences of other people. And now that they care, now it's the only thing that matters, which is a classic, you know, problem. It's like one of those things where people say, well, I didn't care about X, but now I'm a parent, so porn is terrible. So it's like, well, where were you when you were single? Like, oh, you're unable to have an imaginative sympathy outside of your own experience to understand why things are so societally bad? Is that really so hard for you? Anyway, that's my problem with that. You know, now that I'm feeling this pain, obviously the pain is worse than it ever was. Not, you know, I was just living in my own little, you know, my own little bubble here.
Well, but this is where I think the message matters, because the public debate we're seeing, and I know that a lot the private debates many Americans are having right now about slogans like defund the police or abolish the police, you know, we do see there are people who really believe that that's the answer. The Black Lives Matter chapter in DC has called for the abolition of prisons, for the abolition of capitalism, for the destruction of the nuclear family. These are all stated goals that they proudly proclaim. And so when you but you can't express unease with those goals anymore because the slogan and the movement are now completely coalesced and embraced by, you know, upper middle class white liberals who, you know, want to march behind it, want to buy a t-shirt and show their solidarity. And in 6 months, when everything's reopened and all their kids are back to school, we'll go back to whatever their cause du jour is.
It's also Schrodinger's slogan.
Yes.
It doesn't exist.
Right.
Once you notice it.
Right.
If you notice it and you're critical of it, it ceases to have any meaning. Because you've criticized it. Right. You just can't comprehend it in its fullness.
What makes this different from Radical Chic in 1970 and what makes it different from the silent majority days, right? When Nixon asked the country to express its opinion because the majority, he said, was silent, and the largest outpouring of public support for a presidential speech in the history of mankind happened as a result of that, telegrams, letters, calls to the White House and all of that in 1969, the silent majority was silent because it had no way to be loud, right? So what we have now is social media, which can create a new enforcement mechanism. Abe, you sent us yesterday in our group chat a piece about an actress in LA who created a Google Sheets database of theater companies across the United States that did not issue a statement supporting Black Lives Matter. And suddenly, because that document could be accessed by everyone, right? Because it was an open Google sheet somewhere or other, right, every theater company in the United States had to issue a statement aligning itself politically with the Black Lives Matter movement. And of course, Black Lives Matter movement is a highly problematic thing, not only because it calls for the abolishing the police, but because its organizers were systematically and disgustingly anti-Semitic, as we talked about yesterday, and all of that. But no matter, if you don't do it, then you're on a list, and the list is forever. And so you better do something to get your name off the list, because like in somewhere on Long Island, they were doing a production of a musical called Curtains by Candor and Ebb, and the entire production fell apart because somebody in the theater company didn't properly celebrate Black Lives Matter, and every equity actor who was in the production quit the production out of fear that they would be tagged with having been part of a systematic racist system. So you have that. You have the National Poetry Foundation, which was left a colossal amount of money. Weird little group. They published Poetry Magazine, and like 10, 15 years ago, might have been Doris Duke. I don't remember who it was. Somebody left them a colossal amount of money out of nowhere, like $150 million. Okay, so it publishes, it gives out grants. It doesn't know what to do with this money, apparently. So now there's an organized effort to blackmail the National Poetry Foundation into using its proceeds to give money to Black Lives Matter, or to give money to Black poets specifically, or something like that. And it's organized instantaneously, and suddenly there are 150,000 people, you know, who have never read a poem in their lives who can sign on to it. And then you have this kind of totalitarian enforcement of a new norm in 5 seconds.
So this actually has prompted me to wonder why, when we faced a global pandemic, we were told by lots of people that we needed to listen to the experts. We needed to listen to the epidemiologists who had studied previous pandemics, who knew what we should do. Our policymakers should listen to what they said. We saw them on TV, on press conferences ad nauseum. And there was something to be said for that. If you think that the racism that's being decried in all of this protest is itself like a virus, which we've seen many people make that comparison, then why aren't we hearing from the criminologists, the sociologists, the scholarly experts who have spent their careers and lives studying effective versus ineffective policing. Because I do want to hear from those people. I want to know, what is it that we could be doing practically differently to make policing both more effective and have less of a disparate impact on communities that shouldn't be experiencing that? And how can we look at the data? Remember, we were always told to look at the data when we're talking about the pandemic. I want to see crime data discussed. I want to see explanations given for why certain techniques in certain areas might be tried and whether or not they're effective. I mean, this is the sort of expertise that is lacking in this conversation because, and we were talking about this, you know, the other day, it's emotional right now. But my fear is that we're not going to get into that second order discussion. I mean, Congress right now is debating a police reform bill. How much of the expertise that we need to hear from is actually going to be represented in that? And how much of this is just going to be more shouting at each other?
Well, some of this is designed to just incentivize shouting. The New York Times published an editorial about 5 days ago from a writer named Chad Sanders, who contributed to something that Abe has been talking about for a while, which is this phenomenon in which writers and anti-racist activists provide white people with lists of things you can do in this moment, not just, you know, speak out, but act, similar to the theater company letter. And one of his recommendations seems extremely unhealthy. One of them is to texts to your relatives and loved ones, telling them that you will not be visiting them or answering phone calls until they take significant action in supporting Black Lives, either through protests or financial contributions. So it's like an indulgence. It's like, it's a very religious kind of concept that there has to be some sort of a sacrifice on your part in the form of either a financial contribution or action on your part, but also withholding affection from the people in your lives as sort of a show of solidarity. It's really, really unhealthy and has absolutely nothing to do with police reform. It's about, you know, demonstrating your fealty to this cause through sacrifice.
But also, I mean, I think, you know, part of the problem here regarding data is that those who are calling for radical police reforms or defunding and abolishing of police forces, they don't want the data because the data complicates the picture enormously, and they're not going to like where the data goes. That which is why there's been no discussion of crime rate by neighborhood and things like that in any of this, because it completely complicates the picture of an overzealous racist police force wantonly breaking Black bodies.
I mean, we've gotten feedback to the extent for us on this podcast that the kind of data-driven analysis that you engage in is just deeply unhelpful and sort of reflective of a lack of understanding of what this moment is and what this moment calls for. And to an extent, that's true, because as you say, it's not a data-driven phenomenon.
It's emotional.
And the kind of incremental reforms that Congress is pursuing, this is something I've been writing about forever, that incrementalism is an enemy of the kind of radical reformation that this moment demands.
By the way, you know, one of these major reforms that happened as a result of, you know, what was seen to be or deemed to be excessive policing in the last 10 years has been responsible. I mean, this is an interesting case, right? So body cams are now all over the place. Body cams are a reform of the previous decade to deal with these incidents of what people saw as excessive police brutality. So there would be a record at the time, at the place, at the scene, a passive video record, so that we did not have to rely solely on the independent accounts of the officers themselves dealing with incidents, right? And people said, those who were skeptical of the value of this said, this could lead to worse circumstances where you would have these pieces of footage, which are wildly, which involve an incredibly tiny subset of police officers nationwide, come to seem the synecdoche, you know, like the object of the whole, like they are the thing that proves what the whole is like. that Chauvin in Minneapolis is American policing, because we obviously that wasn't a body cam, but you know, but or these guys, what you see there is a thing in time, and you don't see the 688,000 other people who are police officers and what they do all day. And I think that is a real, this is one of those sort of unintended consequence things where this was done in an effort to address something that was seen to be a terrible injustice, right? And to provide new evidence to make sure that people were kept on the straight and narrow. And I think it's made things worse, not better.
Well, and but for the activists, it doesn't matter, right? Because so Black Lives Matter sent out a tweet the other day in the DC chapter, in a weird sort of surreal, the left eating itself moment, criticizing Mayor Muriel Bowser for painting a Black Lives Matter mural, and saying this doesn't go far enough. She's just, you know, play acting at the real radicalism, which you want. And it listed a number of cases in just in DC of African American men who were killed by police. And just listed their names and their ages and said they were killed by police. I went through every single case and I tried to understand the context for every single death. And in a couple of cases, it was clear use of inappropriate force or bad police. It was bad policing. I think it was two of those that I discovered. Every single other case involved a person who was either actively shooting at or attempting to get a weapon from or physically attacking a police officer when the police officer was doing his job to prevent further violence from this individual. Their names are, it doesn't matter. The context doesn't matter for the more radical wing of this movement because it's just a list of names. So the statistics are being used, but they're being used in a way that's so removed from any kind of nuance or context that even challenging the lack of nuance is now considered something you cannot do and should not do.
I really don't think it's fair to say that additional public oversight of police forces is something that has made things worse. We didn't have statistics on arrest-related deaths in 2015. We do now. I don't see how that's bad.
New York City, not bad. But that was done, by the way, that was done by...
There's more than this. New York City is beginning to eliminate this notion that you should keep these complaints private, which is a product of police unions and their radical oversight over these. This is something, these are public institutions that need public oversight. And it's something to, more information here is not a bad thing. And I don't think it's contributed to what people feared it would, critics of these reforms feared it would, which is an increase in criminal activity in places that police decline now to police.
Well, not yet. But for example, take the case of the private reports, right? I mean, I am not a believer in public sector unions. I think they're bad. And I think cop unions are bad. I think teachers unions are, I think they're bad. Having said that, the idea that every complaint against a police officer should be made public, that's like the classic problem of the, you know, system of anonymous reporting or any kind of reporting. Like how in a system where the innocent are proven guilty, like a grand jury proceeding is supposed to remain secret until or unless, you know, someone is indicted, right? The very thing that was violated by James Comey when he came out and said they weren't indicting Hillary, but she kind of probably did bad things anyway. So, I mean, that's the argument to be made about the report, about the question of whether or not reports against cops should be made public. Having said that, obviously there is this doctrine of qualified immunity that involves how to hold public officials liable for their actions while in performance of their public duties. That is, I think, part of the House bill. Eliminating the extension and expansion of the doctrine of qualified immunity, that is probably a very valuable thing, because there you have, on the one hand, you can see why you're providing a certain kind of liability protection for people who work for the government, and not making them personally liable for actions that they're taking theoretically to help with the common weal. And on the other hand, that really is a way in which no one can be held accountable for anything if they work for the government, which is obviously problematic in itself. So these are complicated issues, is what I mean. And not all, by the way, and the database issue, the question of whether we have databases on these kind of crimes, most of that is the result of a change in reporting. It's the Washington Post who created the database of of black shootings or the interactions between African Americans and cops in the United States. It's not the government. It's not a change in policy. It's a change in the fact that a journalistic institution was willing to pay a lot of money to collect this data. I think.
But again, even that data is not presented in a context. I mean, to go back to your body cameras point, we need to look at interactions between law enforcement and citizens and get a picture and a sense of how much of this is common and part of the culture of particular police forces, and how much of it is as, you know, defenders of the police say, you know, just one bad apple. So I do think that, like, I'm more data is better, but I do think that the context, again, we have to talk about crime rates in certain parts of the country. We have to talk about the number of interactions and the likelihood of higher interactions. The weirdest statistic I've seen bandied about in the last few weeks is the one where a lot of Americans say, you know, policing of African-American communities is unfair and needs to be looked at, right? There's like sort of broad agreement that Americans are coming to that didn't exist before about that. And that is credit to the protests for elevating people's consciousness of that and willing to make it a point of discussion. However, there's also similar polling that shows the people who still want the police, and although they distrust the police, they still want them in their neighborhood the most, are the same communities that are, I mean, these, you know, African-American high crime neighborhoods want the cops in their neighborhoods. They don't necessarily trust the cops, but they understand there is a need for them. So that's where, like, there's the data only tells us part of the story in almost every case, but if we don't have it at all, we're just shouting. We're not.
Oversight is only gonna get you a quarter of the way there at most.
Yeah.
What nobody wants to talk about and what needs to happen in order to make this effective is to look at the application of law, that we have a lot of laws on the books that are being enforced selectively.
Yes.
Because there are so many of them, which breeds a sense of hypocrisy, which is absolutely justified because it is hypocrisy. Things like civil asset forfeiture is something that police should absolutely not be capable of doing. The amount of enforcement of the drug laws in American urban centers as opposed to American suburbs and exurbs and rural areas is completely disparate. And it's the kind of thing that breeds a sense of resentment. And as long as we have all these laws on the books, no amount of oversight is going to allow you to effectively police them uniformly.
Right. And then you also have training. I will give you an example of what I'm talking about. In the 1970s and 1980s in New York City, the largest police department in the United States, and, you know, the city that had the most aggregate number of crimes, though not in percentage terms, cops were vastly more likely to pull their revolvers in the course of any sort of crime interdiction of any kind. In part because the policy of 911 policing meant that when they were pursuing criminals, they were pursuing criminals in the heat, or if they got themselves involved in incidents or something like that, they got themselves involved in incidents, you know, two-thirds of the way through, and they pulled their guns and they were much more likely to use them. The number of times that a police officer in New York City now uses a gun, pulls a gun, is involved with a gun, or discharges a gun is in the, like, it's on two or three hands. Like, it doesn't happen very often at all. In Los Angeles famously had a violent police department because the department was incredibly small and the geographical area that it had to cover was incredibly large. There were like 8,000 cops in LA for this, you know, 250 square mile county. And they actually literally pursued a kind of open policy of, if you get involved with the cops, they're going to kick the crap out of you, because the only way they could enforce law was to terrify criminals into being more placid. And then after the, you know, Daryl Gates, the police chief, was fired after the Rodney King incident, the entire way that LA cops were taught and trained to deal with the public and how to behave in the interdiction or dealing with a crime or incidents on this, it was totally revolutionized for the better. So that's where you have reforms that involve a serious systematic look at how to do this better that will help everybody, right? And then, so you can say that stop and frisk, which was the policy in New York that got so many guns off the streets and all of that, was used for too long and was too draconian and all of that, right? But it was better than what went on in the 1980s, when if you didn't have stop and frisk, criminals had guns with impunity and cops were pulling their guns with impunity, and there was a lot more crossfire. So that's where the complexity starts coming in. And of course the activists don't want this, because they're not interested in reform. They're interested in revolution. They don't want incremental change that makes things better. They want to overthrow the system and have social workers replace cops. They don't want cops. They don't want cops to get better. Part of what they've been doing here is trying to make cops act viciously. You know, they riot and loot and do this to make cops interact with people violently, to make the case against cops even worse.
This was actually the argument of a New York Times opinion column today by Farhad Manju. Like, look, see, we told you, you know, rioting, looting, throwing bottles and bricks at cops, and they respond really aggressively. See, we need to abolish the police. It's ridiculous.
Well, he's a joy. He's a thrilling joy.
Did he really argue abolish the police? Because I've been very authoritatively informed that no one is saying that.
Well, it's not.
No, no one. Of course, no one.
He doesn't really mean it, but it sounds really fun to say it, and like the thrill of revolution that overtakes the people who say it, which is then immediately backtracked on. It's words.
I mean, that was the claim from the Minneapolis City Council that they envision a future in which cops simply cease to exist, in part because we become some sort of a grand commune, and as John likes to say, the seas turn into lemonade.
Like in Seattle, right? Isn't that currently what's happening?
Oh my God, Capitol Hill neighborhood in Seattle.
Yeah, so this is more Occupy than anything, a remnants of Occupy. It's the city has ceded a series of blocks to these protesters, which has become quite anarchic. And, you know, they're having a lot of difficulty keeping people from stealing things and from vandalizing people and being violent towards one another. It's all Occupy 2.0. But what's interesting and terrifying slash hilarious, is this graphic that I saw associated with this protest. It's called the Capitol Hill Free Zone, and it resembles everything you've seen from the Syrian Civil War. It has this graph where this is this area that's controlled by the demonstrators, and there's this safe zone where people over here will give you assistance if needed. And this is the, quote, regime-occupied Safeway, e.g. the police, a hotel where police are stationed. They're playing at transforming Seattle into Aleppo, and it is a game. It's insurrectionary costume play, but it's not
costume play. It's the opposite of costume play. It's actually really happening. That's why it's not cosplay. I mean, Occupy in New York City took place in a vest pocket park down by Wall Street that, for complicated reasons, could not be, was sort of public private property, and people could not be rousted out of it by contract. And so this was very deliberately chosen. People moved into it. And then you had these kind of lunatic, remember, there were drum circles, and there was the megaphone speech where people would repeat the speeches that other people made, and there was afternoon dancing and stuff like that. And then by the end, as it turned out, there were probably as many undercover cops living in the park as there were, you know, radicals. But, you know, this turned into just sort of like a display of lunacy, right? The Occupy Wall Street movement. People were saying things when the cops finally went in and broke it up after 6 months. People were saying things like, they are destroying my home. This is my home. This, like, Zuccotti Park, this, like, three quarters of a block, you know, a park that was put there because it was a tax dodge for the developer who was building the building nearby. This is something else. This is an actual neighborhood in Seattle that has been ceded to the anarchists.
But the only thing that makes it more theater than not is the fact that Seattle governance and Seattle law enforcement are not the Assad regime, and they're not firing on them, and they're not sending in barrel bombs and right. And
no, you know, the opposite, right? They ceded the territory.
Pleasure, yeah. Right. It's just at the pleasure of local.
Absolutely authorities. Right. They're giving them the space to do this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's part. You know, it's like if the Paris Commune had been, you know, sort of like, oh, go into the Paris Commune now, you 1870s people. Please enjoy living under your separate government. Right? And we'll just.
But it's, yeah. Isn't it more like Rumspringa for a certain class of like radicalized privileged kids? I mean, this is when I see these flyers in my neighborhood, all I can think of is and Noah, you said, yeah, like these are not actual activists from the street who are trying to persuade already persuaded rich liberal right. white people to join their cause. I mean, I do think in some ways the theater point is well taken because there is a kind of performative aspect to so much of this that in some ways the more radical activists are taking extremely good advantage of, right? They're sort of playing this game where the people who are with them as allies and who are buying into this and, you know, questioning their feelings about looting are being co-opted for a much more radical agenda. And the question is, are we going to be able to separate those out in the way that we did after Occupy and after other protest movements to actually, A, achieve the reforms that I think a large number of Americans would like to see, but also to kind of quell that more anarchist, radical strain that has never been effective at bringing about real change in this country.
The story of Occupy was one of a terrible miscalculation by Democrats who very early on wrapped their arms around it as though it was a species of political activism akin to the Tea Parties. They thought it would just provide a lot of grassroots energy for Democratic GOTV efforts in 2012. And what it did was essentially delegitimize a lot of the reforms, early reforms that Democrats have been advocating along the lines that Occupy was favoring, a radical reformation of banking and half a dozen other progressive ideals that they lacked legitimacy after global protests turned into global insurrectionary violence. The sacking of the port in Oakland was a turning point moment.
Right. Well, that's what Abe was saying is that, you know, what was more helpful to the cause there? The passage of legislation in 2010, 2011 to control the banks, despite the fact that no one from Wall Street went to jail over the meltdown, or Occupy, which, as you say, I think arguably set back that process, which could have deepened and gotten and pulled the, you know, opened the Overton window on these issues much more effectively than this, you know, street level nonsense. But I don't know that you can say that about what's going on now. That's the problem. The analogy now is that this is bigger and deeper and larger, and that you have something that I think is more elementally or existentially threatening to the country than a war against the banks.
But doesn't that presuppose that this is this view of this woman who spoke to the Washington Post is popular enough to capture a plurality sentiment in this country? I can't imagine that it achieves even anything remotely resembling that. This defund the police slogan, for example, was polled by YouGov and found that a whopping 16% right. were in support.
Right.
People don't like violence.
You know, but this, you know, this is something I've been thinking about. This brings us, you know, we've been discussing for a couple of years now the question of to what extent the radical Twitter mobs represent the American liberal left, right? Or whether they're just a bunch of sort of no account fringy people who don't have any real larger impact on things. Where do the current troubles leave us in regard to that discussion? I mean, clearly this is much larger than I think the Twitter voices that we could argue were amplified, but in fact much smaller than their impact would have suggested. I think this is larger.
Well, let's talk about the politics then for a couple of minutes, okay? Because we have, you know, as I've been saying, over the last week and a half, we have the worst polling of Trump's presidency aside from Charlottesville, right at a moment when he can ill afford it. You know, Biden is now nationally up by 8. He's up in every one of the swing states, kind of outside the margin of error, it would appear. And yet, if Noah's right, and if the general sentiment that we all seem to feel is, you know, in the body politic is correct, it's not that Biden is playing with fire, because I think he's not doing much of anything. But if Trump cannot turn this to his advantage, either we will see him in the future as a uniquely as a figure uniquely ill disposed to a political moment, that he had his one moment in 2016 dealing with a very specific set of circumstances, but didn't, you know, it's like he's a pitcher. It turned out he only has a fastball and he can't, you know, he doesn't have other pitches when he needs them. Or the country will have changed markedly and substantially and in ideological ways that are very surprising to us, and that this kind of attitude has been mainstreamed, and that it is, and that enough people, that people aren't offended or upset enough by it, that it will change their vote. I don't know how you can read that piece, by the way, the Washington Post piece, and not think that Minnesota is in play. That I say, if Meredith Webb, nice, you know, white woman from this neighborhood in Minneapolis, who is already a Warren voter and all of that, but if she is now a supporter of looting, and has been driven and is a kind of voice that is heard throughout 2020 in Minneapolis and in Minnesota, where people say, well, people in Minneapolis support the looters, and you live in White Bear Lake, which is where my grandparents had a house on the lake outside St. Paul for, you know, 50 years. And the people in White Bear Lake, 20 minutes outside of St. Paul, see that. Aren't they going to vote en masse for Trump to save themselves?
Look, you have to tease these threads out. We have seen no polls that suggest America's priority has shifted from the pandemic and the economic crisis to this. It may yet, but we have not seen that data, which suggests just because all the Twitter and all the press are focused on this one issue does not mean every voter is. Joe Biden himself has been very unequivocal about the defund the police thing. He says no, he doesn't give it any oxygen whatsoever. And the story of Joe Biden's ascension to this nomination has been his avoidance of all these radical traps left and right over the course of a year. So, and it took some discipline to get there. So let's not assume that he's going to give in to this pressure that's going to be on him to adopt these radical slogans. That being said, you can assume that this race is going to tighten after the conventions. They always do. And then the notion that this is going to be a 9-point race from now to November doesn't seem likely based on past history. So we expect it to tighten. And I'm of the mind that the president can't overcome the headwinds that are associated with everything. Just look around, you know, gestures, everything. But that being said, I would be surprised if we didn't see a tightening around these issues, if it persists, if this becomes the national conversation into the conventions, into the fall. It doesn't make any sense that Americans wouldn't reject a party that is sort of okay with burning things to the ground.
Well, and especially at the, I'll be curious to watch local elections, state and local elections, because, you know, let's be honest, there's only so much that Trump can actually do to resolve anything. These are local issues. These are in cities that are often have been under the control of Democratic mayors for decades. The mayors are in charge of the police force. I mean, we do actually have people who will split their ticket who can't stand Trump, and you can see them voting for Biden, especially if Biden holds to this more, you know, doesn't succumb to the radical sloganeering, but who at the local level, where law and order is actually, you know, right there and on their local city councils or in their local races, could vote much more conservative. I mean, that would be one solution to the issue.
It's always the ring.
That's a really good point. And this is something we've been saying for a while, that the Republican Senate has the capacity to save their bacon here, yes, by latching on to local GOP officials who actually have the authority, capacity, and record of mitigating the threat of violence. And they can say, listen, these are the guys that, you know, we support, that you support, you know, whatever you do. It's tough to think of a parallel in which the the top of the ticket loses by a substantial margin and doesn't take every down ballot race with him. But ticket splitting is a thing. We've been seeing more of it over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. And Republican Senate has a real opportunity here to say, you know, law and order, you know, is a real concern for you. And we are the law and order party.
Okay. I'm not sure I agree with this. I think that where the salvation for the Trump campaign and the GOP and all of this comes is not from the governance, but rather from the suburbs that ring the disorder and the decay. I mean, in other words, if you live outside Philadelphia, if you live outside Minneapolis, obviously, if you live outside Portland and Seattle and places like that, and you really see the decay that is that may potentially threaten you, LA, you know, stuff like that, that's where you may see a kind of shy Tory effect of the sort that we have rarely seen. That is to say, people are not going to say they're going to vote for Trump. They're not going to say they're going to vote for Republicans necessarily. But if something happens in the week before the election, you know, or as people are reminded of what's going on, if there's some kind of element of a public disorder that is raised by this, inside cities, they may like say, well, Biden seems okay, but I, you know, these people are scaring me. Like I can't vote for them. Like what happens? They don't want cops. And what happens if they come into my neighborhood? You know, I don't know. That's where I think you could get that effect. I don't know that hooking yourself to good local officials is necessarily the answer, but who knows? I mean, we're also 5 months away from the election, so it's a long time. And you know, Trump was impeached 5 months ago, and who remembers that? Huh. You know, I sort of imagine that we'll forget. We won't forget this, but maybe we will. I mean, have we forgotten
the
pandemic? Corona
is not going away. Hospitalizations are on the rise.
Okay, that's Corona, but that's Corona.
And this. I mean, the violence that we didn't think would go away after 3 days really did go away after 3 days.
Well, it went away after 9 days, to be fair. Because,
okay, fair enough. But roughly the trajectory of a violent spasm of society that we've, you know, people who study this sort of thing, mm-hmm. it tapers out on its own. It sort of tapered out on its own.
Right. And then there will be another push.
Yeah. There'll be a big legislative push towards, police reform in Washington. But then we have to get around to phase 4 because we still need phase 4. At which point the economic crisis and the pandemic become the central central topic of discussion in Washington, which makes it the central topic of discussion during the presidential debates. And
yeah,
elections.
And then somebody will take a cell phone camera image of a brutal police incident somewhere or other, and then what happens then?
Well, and there's a huge rally being called for in August in D.C. So you're going to have basically a reboot of how will Trump manage the area around the White House? How will he manage all the protesters? I mean, last Saturday was peaceful. A lot of people was peaceful. Hopefully this one will be peaceful, too. But there's sort of an encore performance that's being prepared for August on these same issues of policing and race that in D.C. at least could lead to another series of photo ops that will trail him into the election.
Well, they could trail him, or he could get wise after a while. I mean, that is to say, you know, more I've been thinking about this, the more I think of the incredibly blown political opportunity that was represented by the past week, because he could have acted like a leader, by which I mean he could have come out and said, "This is a terrible moment in America. You know, we saw something terrible happen to George Floyd. Something needs to be done about it. And I think we all agree about that. But the order in this country has got to be preserved. Police, you know, are heroes who are protecting us. And there is a middle ground between, accepting, we can't accept police brutality, but we have to accept authority." And it's like not a big call, not a big ask. And he flailed all over the place. And, you know, because he's more like a caller to a talk show than he is like a leader. But 2 months of prep and the possibility of losing the election in November could concentrate his mind, and he could respond better.
They'll have
in
to take his Twitter account away. I mean, he's literally tweeting conspiracy theories about a 75-year-old right. man being, you know, some sort of Antifa. I mean, it is. And actually, I had a lot of I saw a lot of people point out that even if you think that guy did something sort of foolish by getting right in a cop's face, and you know, when they told him to move, that it was. The fact that the cops then walked past him after he'd been pushed, I mean, that was just one of those visuals that people are also going to remember. And he brought attention to it on the wrong, he was on the wrong side of that issue.
When you face a world historical, potential world historical humiliation, that can concentrate the mind even of the most insane Twitter, obsessive.
Maybe.
I don't know. Not for a narcissist. All attention.
Would you have thought that I could quit Twitter?
Well, that's
you would not have thought that I could quit Twitter. But I quit Twitter, and so
he's currently spending this morning yelling at Fox News.
You need to start a support group and invite the president.
I am saying we need a couple more months, but I am saying that there will be sufficient. Look. The other thing is all the polling that really, really slammed him this weekend. Most of it, a lot of it was, sort of before both some of it was before the really good economic news, number one, and then some of the worst of the looting and rioting, number two. So, the polling this week may show something different. But if it doesn't,
Gallup poll today shows him dropping 10 points in job approval rating over the course of a month to 39%.
Okay, I didn't see that one. So, okay, you know what? I'm wrong. So let's table this till tomorrow. We end on a low note for me and for America. So for Noah Rothman, Christine Rosen, and Abe Greenwald, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.